This is an ABC podcast.
The government says the health system is in the worst shape it's been in 40 years. So can it be fixed? G'day, I'm David Lipson, coming to you from Gadigal land in Sydney. Also coming up on This Week, advocates of The Voice met in Canberra, but the No campaign is firming up too in what looks like an increasingly messy battle. And should streaming services be forced to produce more Australian content? Consensus can be tricky, but there seems to be plenty of agreement that the Medicare system is not working well. From the Minister...
Frankly, I think our general practice system right now is in the worst shape it has been in the 40-year history of Medicare.
To the doctors...
A lot of younger doctors coming through the system want to be able to have good income and a good lifestyle. I think GP used to offer that, but now you take the lifestyle balance, but you take the money cut. And I think that's just unfortunately being reflected in the number of graduates going through into general practice.
And of course, the patients. This week, the federal government started the process of revamping Medicare, stressing the long road ahead.
I want to tell Australians, honestly, it's not going to be quick and it's not going to be easy and it's not going to be fixed in one budget. But this report sets a very clear challenge to government about how we start to turn things around in general practice and primary care more broadly. And this government is up for that challenge.
The report he referred to was short on specific solutions and funding models, but did outline a vision for coordinated teams of healthcare professionals, doctors, nurses, physios, pharmacists, along with more after-hours care and the ability for longer consultations.
The overall fundamental design of Medicare hasn't stood the test of time well.
Health economist Stephen Duckett is on the task force that wrote the report.
Some parts have gone well. The idea of people being able to choose a private doctor, the idea of rebates and so on, actually works well. But Medicare was designed in the 1960s, and back then there were solo GPs, small group practices with partnerships. The population mostly fronting up to doctors for acute types of issues. Now, general practice is increasingly owned by big corporates who are listed on the stock exchange or venture capitalists. Very different orientation from what it was in the 1960s. The population is very different in terms of illness profile, many more people with multi-chronic illnesses. And so we've got to actually say, well, things have changed a lot. How does Medicare need to change as a result of all of that?
Okay, so clearly some big issues that need addressing. Looking at some of the solutions, one of the big items is integrated care. These are kind of one-stop shops for medical services. Why do you think they are so important?
So if we look back to the 1960s when Medicare was designed, we had solo practices, GPs or a small partnership. If there was a physio, they were down the road in a separate, complete private practice. As I said, one of the issues now is multi-morbidity, multi-chronic illnesses. And so you've got to have much more integration of that physio or that podiatrist or whatever into the general practice rather than separate competing services. So you want to say, look, if I've got low back pain and I ring up the practice, do I have to go and see a GP before I get a Medicare rebate for the physio? Or can the practice say, look, we've got a physio on staff here, they'll deal with you directly rather than have to go through the GP. So the service will be integrated, the physio plus the GP is going to be integrated, but the patient gets a better service, a more relevant service, and in a sense, a quicker service as well.
We have heard a good deal of opposition to this idea already. There is some concern, for example, that we don't have enough nurses and other health professionals anyway. So do you think all the health groups can get on board with this?
So, yes, we've got shortages of a number of health professions and we need to actually address that as part of a workforce strategy. The previous government abolished Health Workforce Australia in 2014, so it's no surprise if you take your hand off the wheel, things go awry. So we've got to address the workforce issues, but we've also got to make sure we use all the workforce we've got to the fullest extent. You know, we can do things differently, which will make each of the workforce we've got, each of the health professions we've got, might be able to work more efficiently and be a better deal for the patients.
Bulk billing is a massive issue too. It's harder to find. Services are costing more. How do we address that?
What we've got to do is design specific incentives to actually get the bulk billing rate back up again. And that may be changing the way, the total way that practices are funded. For example, you might encourage people to sign up with a general practice, and as part of that, you might put design incentives for bulk billing. So there are lots of ways of doing it, which require a sort of a platform, a redesign of how Medicare funds general practice in order to do it efficiently so we're not wasting taxpayers' money.
Does it just need more money? I mean, why not just pay doctors more by increasing the Medicare rebate?
That may not lead to an increase in the bulk billing rate. You've got to actually say, if you just increase the rebate, that first of all goes to everybody who's doing the right thing already. 84% of all attendances are bulk billed. So you've got to say, how do we use taxpayers' money efficiently? Increasing the take-home pay of a doctor from $250,000 to $300,000 a year may not actually increase bulk billing very much. It may go to the practice owners. It may go to GPs themselves. The government has no control over where it goes. And so you want to actually make sure the money we spent is spent in the right way.
Some of the issues that we're talking about are even more acute in rural and remote areas. What's your advice on addressing those?
So one of the things we've got to recognise is that Australians face different types of issues in different parts of the country. Rural and remote is very different from inner Melbourne and very different from the outer western suburbs of Sydney. So we should not expect to have a one-size-fits-all strategy for improving Medicare. In rural and remote, you've got complexities about Commonwealth and state which have not been handled well over the last couple of decades. And so, for example, the GP who works in a rural town is exactly the same GP who works in the hospital emergency department and exactly the same GP who works in the hospital wards. And so you've got to think, you know, how can we meld the two sources of funding, the hospital funding and the GP funding, to make a better experience for the doctor and a better experience for the patients who live in those rural communities. And the Commonwealth and states have done a little bit on that, but there's much more that needs to be done.
There's also been this push this week to give pharmacists more scope to write prescriptions, for example. Is that a good way, do you think, to ease pressure on doctors?
So my view is we've got to have, where we started from in this conversation, integrated care. That is, the pharmacist and the GP have to be working hand to hand in glove. They have to be working closely with each other. Certainly my view is that if I'm on a script and I have been on the script for the last 3 years, is it feasible for the pharmacist to say, look, I've checked the patient out, we're going to renew the script and give them another set of renewals, or do I have to go back and see the GP? My view is if the GP and the pharmacist work together, there's no reason why the pharmacist can't do that prescription renewal. The big controversy is when the pharmacist is in competition with the general practice, that the pharmacist sees the patient and says, look, I know you can't get in to see the GP, or I know there's a big out-of-pocket for the GP. I've looked at you and this is what we're going to do, and I'm going to prescribe medication.
So the problem, it seems, is becoming much more clear for a lot of people, or the problems, I should say. But there's no quick fix here. So how long is it going to take for us to get Medicare back into shape?
My view is we've got to get the foundations right. The government has to put in a whole lot of money, and they've committed $250 million a year, into changing the way the funds flow to general practice. And so once we've got a better foundation, then we can start to say, well, we've addressed the foundation, now we've got to address all the other problems as well, and that will cost way more than the government has put on the table so far. That will take a number of budgets and, you know, ideally in the budget before the next election, the government will say, we now know how to fix the problem, we've got the foundations right, and this is what we're putting on the table.
That's Honorary Professor, Health Economist Stephen Duckett. Well, the proposed amendment to the Constitution on an Indigenous voice to Parliament grew a little this week. The government's working group recommended 15 new words, in addition to what Anthony Albanese proposed last year, to more clearly recognise Australia's First People in our founding document.
It's not just for First Nations communities to kick into gear and say yes now. It's up for all Australians.
There are also growing jitters amongst supporters of The Voice about momentum in the no camp.
Our country is pretty much conservative in terms of change, and we've got to really work with all people to try and encourage them to feel courageous in that change and unafraid to take the steps, because this is a significant moment.
Dan Borscher is the ABC's voice correspondent.
This was really the first discussion that this group has had for this year, when we know this is going to be an enormous focus. We're going to be voting at some point later this year. And this was also a chance for that group to start to consider the sequence of words that the Prime Minister announced at the Garma Festival on Yolngu Country in Arnhem Land late last year. And they've asked that there be an extra sentence, including in that wording, that is an introductory sentence that is about really setting the tone, if you will, ahead of the other words. And it would be in recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples as the First Peoples of Australia, there shall be a body to be called the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Voice. And there was also a slight tweak to some of the language, and that was particularly around what the group or the body would be called. So they say the names Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Voice and First Peoples Voice are preferable to the name First Nations Voice. And they said that even though that came from the voice process itself, that on consideration and consultation, that this would be much more clearer. And also they said that that would include legal clarity as well. So I think that's an interesting point that I suspect we'll see and hear more about later on. And then there was a very brief reference to sovereignty at the end.
I want to ask you about the attendance of the opposition leader, Peter Dutton, who dialed in via video link, which in itself is significant because he has some big, big questions about this, reservations, you'd have to say. And he has those reservations still coming out of the meeting, but he's agreed to attend more meetings. So what do we read from this? Is it a win for the Yes camp or not?
Well, I think some of the elders that were in the room say that it's important to maintain that dialogue. So they're certainly seeing this as a win, that there was that initial conversation and that Mr. Dutton and also the Indigenous leadership in that group have said there will be more of these conversations to happen. There is, of course, still this lingering question, David, over the detail that Mr. Dutton asked for. He wrote that letter to the Prime Minister that had 15 questions in it, and we've heard Mr. Dutton saying that the Prime Minister's refusal to answer straightforward questions on how his voice proposal will work is untenable. So even though there were those conversations, Mr. Dutton is still very much maintaining his position of where he's sitting on this, and that's that there is no consolidated position for or against from the Liberal Party at this stage.
Yeah, so the opposition's position on this is still unsettled, still an open question. But this week there was a launch of sorts for the no camp. What arguments have they put up this week? And who are they?
Yeah, well, this is really being led in part by Warren Mundine, who is, of course, the former president of the Labor Party and is also a former candidate for the Liberal Party. He's leading this charge along with a number of members of Parliament, including Jacinta Namba-Jimba-Price, the CLP senator from the Northern Territory, John Anderson, the former leader of the Nationals, as well as other current and former members, including former Labor members of Parliament as well. And the proposal that he put up doing this soft launch this week was really around looking into broader recognition. And he proposed...
This is Warren Mundine.
Yeah, that's Warren Mundine. He threw this idea out there that he would, that there should be broader recognition that includes for migrant Australians, and that he was really making this case as one of equity.
I believe we should be recognising people, First Nations, the recognition of this country and paying respect to them. We should also be recognising the migrants, refugees, other people who have come to this country, escaping war zones and dreadful stuff overseas and contributed to this country to make it such a great country that it is.
This is particularly interesting because, of course, Warren Mundine is an Indigenous man. He knows the background of what led to this conversation. That point around recognition of migrant Australians was pretty quickly and swiftly shot down by leaders across the migrant community, in business, in religious groups, who said, well, actually, we haven't asked for this. And so what we've seen then is perhaps this was just the launching point about creating an extra conversation, or perhaps there were some other motivations about why exactly Warren Mundine decided to go with that as a kind of policy discussion.
Perhaps, do you think, was he trying to plant a seed of doubt in the minds of, well, not just the migrant community, but all Australians as to a question of fairness? Why is this one group of Australians getting special recognition in our founding document?
That's certainly one of the positions that's been put forward following those comments from Warren Mundine, that this was about actually taking the conversation back a step and saying, well, is this about elevating one group over another? And aren't we a democracy that is built on equality and equity?
It's interesting that Warren Mundine was essentially asking for an additional piece, sentence, to be put in the Constitution to include migrants, while at the same time his colleague on this No campaign, John Anderson, was ultimately saying, well, in fact, perhaps we should be removing the 1967 amendment that gave the government the power to legislate on matters affecting Indigenous Australians.
I think that it would be better if we removed all vestiges of those sorts of measurements.
So are they all united in the no camp here?
I think that's a very good question. And it would seem, at least from those comments we've seen from Warren Mundine and John Anderson, that no, in fact, they are not on the same page, and that there are a broad range of views within their group.
Look, the various polls seem to indicate strong support for The Voice amongst Australians. But how firm do you think that support is, particularly as the debate grows louder and the opponents of a change to the Constitution get louder?
Yeah, I think those involved in the campaigns would say, David, that the polling is very soft right now. We saw a poll come out that the Uluru Dialogue Commission, of about 300 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, that had around 80% support. That's a very small number of people and really not statistically sound. A number of the other surveys and polls that have happened so far have been indicating support ranging really from the low 50s up to the 60s and 70s. Most people think that that's soft now. And also, I think it's really important to note that we are right at the start of this year and of this conversation in earnest. And we're still waiting to see very much where those political parties that have been touched upon, where they land on this. What is the government's campaign going forward? Are they going to be investing in broader communications to have a national conversation? And how do all of these things impact on all of the other conversations and things that are happening in the nation right now?
That's Dan Borsha, the ABC's voice correspondent. Okay, pop quiz. Name this theme song from a 90s television show. Yep, that's Heartbreak High, a breakthrough series that showed the nation an edgy, or some would say more honest, version of Australian school life. Now, when the show was rebooted for the 2020s, the success was global.
My best friend dumped me!
I'm a rager!
Thanks to the streaming service Netflix, which produced it.
Oh, there's a fully gut sex map in the old stairwell!
But sadly, mega success stories for Aussie productions like this are rare. And that's something the federal government wants to change.
This is about our soul. This is about our identity. It is so important because it's about who we are and being able to express ourselves and about our quality of life.
This week, the Albanese government released its new national cultural policy. Among the announcements, a plan to introduce quotas for streaming services. The film and television industry certainly approve. Matthew Dina is CEO of Screen Producers Australia.
We know that the biggest industries globally are the United States and the United Kingdom, so that will become our nation's narratives if we don't do something like this.
What's missing and what's crucial is the detail.
The existing quotas that we have on free-to-air, those are based around a cultural policy of making sure that Australians could see themselves in the shows that they were watching. So one of the really tricky parts of this is separating what is economic policy from what is cultural policy.
Amanda Lotz is a professor at the Digital Media Research Centre at Queensland University of Technology.
So an economic policy is something pursued by the government with the aim of increasing jobs. So when we talk about how many jobs are created by offering tax rebates for production, that's an economic policy. A cultural policy is typically done to create a certain kind of content for the people. It's promoting Australian culture in some way. It is delivering a cultural return to Australians. That's entirely separate from whether or not there are jobs created or not.
So could you, for example, point to the difference between producing Pirates of the Caribbean here in Australia and producing the movie The Castle?
Exactly. And so the reason why this is confusing is because a lot of the lobbyists around these issues have conflated the economic and the cultural. And so a lot of the lobbying that has been done primarily with the aim of economic ends often is promoted or advertised under the banner of Australians need Australian stories. But we are not going to be guaranteed as Australians those stories unless the policy is done in a very careful way that actually ensures that there will be cultural outcomes, not just jobs.
We've seen this figure of a 20% quota bandied around. It certainly hasn't been confirmed by the government. But what does that figure refer to? Is it dollars or minutes? And how likely is it that that's in the ballpark of where the government will land?
So the 20%, the idea is that 20% of the revenue earned in Australia by streaming services will need to be invested in Australian content. There's lots of vagueness there. Importantly, that's very different from how quotas have worked in other contexts in Australia. So the broadcast quota is a percentage of the broadcast day that must be Australian made. That kind of quota won't work on a streamer because streaming libraries are vast. And just because you create content and it's in a library doesn't mean that anybody's going to watch it. So that would be a really inefficient way to go about it. So putting a quota on the revenue probably makes more sense if you were going to put a quota or try to regulate with a quota. As for the 20%, no, that it's not really a number that I would say makes a lot of sense. Producing that level of content would be an extraordinary ask on those broadcasters. So if this is cultural policy, then we need a high bar for what it takes to meet that Australian content requirement. And probably we aren't looking at a number anywhere in the vicinity of 20% as being appropriate.
Could quotas actually pose any unforeseen dangers to the industry if they're not done right?
Oh, so many. Yes, I mean, we are actually continuing to live in an environment where the policy decisions that were made around the arrival of the cable have had very real consequences for what the availability of channels and services in Australia looks like and where the money is and is it as a result. So whether it is services deciding that the rules are too onerous and that the population that they might reach in Australia isn't worth their time and effort, that's a risk. One of the telling markets is sort of what happened last year in Denmark, where rules were introduced. They weren't governmental, but they were at the production organization level that led not only the foreign services to pull out all of their production, but even the local streaming services stopped all of their production because the rules were simply too onerous. So the potential for backfire is real.
So as you point out, the streaming services really kind of hold the whip hand. They call a lot of the shots these days. They're so big and create so much content. Could they threaten to just pack up and go, as Facebook threatened to do when it was faced with laws about paying for Australian journalism?
Well, of course they can, but I'd push back on this notion that they have the whip hand. Industry-wide, across the globe, the transition that's happening in terms of how content is funded and made and distributed is experiencing a significant disruption. And we haven't figured out the answers, right? This last year was really indicative of that. And we saw the stock valuations drop. If you're paying attention to the conversation in the US, they're saying, you know, these services that are subscriber funded, they're not going to even afford to exist. And that's a really facile way of actually understanding that there's also not advertising money just sitting around waiting to support these services either. So it's not clear that these are viable businesses and how they are viable. We'll get there eventually, but we're not there yet.
That's Amanda Lotz, a professor in the digital media space at Queensland University of Technology. And that's the episode for this week. If you liked it, be sure to subscribe to This Week, which is produced by Madeline Jenner, Nick Grimm, Anna John, and me, David Lipson.